Our show's name pays tribute to the Boer Trekkers of South Africa, who in 1838 soundly defeated 30,000 Zulus on the bank of the Nkomo River, thereafter called Blood River, from the water turning red with the blood of the slain. Miraculously, no Boer Trekker died and only three were wounded. Now, your friend, Eddie Miller, will be your ambassador for tonight's show.
Oh, precious Blood River Radio family, I'd like to thank you so very much for hanging out. I think we had a dynamite hour, not because of me, because if anybody will know, all I did the second hour, I pretty much just brought the fellas in and out of the breaks. The fellas being Will, or we'll call him Texas Will because we can't disclose his identity because you know what would happen to him if the people found out who he was. And we also had Don Wassel. He used to put out a hard copy of America Free, not America Free Press, excuse me, American Freedom News. Now it's online. Freedom News.us. If I got that address wrong, I'll give it back out to the next break if my old mind doesn't forget. But we're transitioning to the third hour now. We have, as promised, and the bitter ender didn't make me a liar. He's came on for the third hour, and because I've already promised the bitter ender is going to come on, and this is Gettysburg month, Gettysburg week, I believe. He's going to outline Gettysburg, and it's I'm almost sad to hear because I think that's what probably broke the back of the Army of Virginia. But the bitter ender is going to tell us all about that. Without further ado, I'm just shutting my mouth up and getting out of the way and letting the professor, the expert, on. How you doing there, bitter ender?
Doing great, Eddie. How are you getting along? How's everything down in the nation's murder capital there in Memphis?
Oh, man. I'll make this quick. This morning, I went out with the young folks. I started out to go, and someone's saying, Pavel, how the hell are you so fast? Well, all you got to do is leave a half hour early. And if you leave early, you get back to the finish line earlier. And I leave in the dark. They didn't see me. But I went through this. Memphis has been voted, and I saw a documentary about this the other day, the second one. The murder capital of the United States, and here I am, my old butt. I'm running this morning on a run before daylight, still dark, in one of the most dangerous sections of the most dangerous city. But I was raised close to that spot, so it's kind of, you know, bullets flying, stuff like that's kind of, it's like mother's milk, like mother's lullaby. Singer me, it's like, boom, boom. It's kind of like, you know, a lullaby to me. It puts me to sleep. Anyway, I guess I'm kind of retarded. But anyway, doing pretty good down here in Memphis. I hadn't been shot yet. I guess that bullet with my name on it hadn't come up. But anyway, how you been doing, Bitter Ender?
Doing fine, doing fine. We got awakened about 11:30 or midnight the other night with people on our street firing off big monster fireworks. They were trying to compete with the fireworks display in downtown Nashville. And, it looks like lightning was in the sky and the windows were shaking. So anyway, we survived all of that nonsense. And well, I thought this week had the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd of July. And as most of our listeners know, the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd of July in 1863 was a battle fought at a little crossroads town in southern Pennsylvania called Gettysburg. And you're right, it did affect the outcome of the war quite a bit. In fact, two events did. The battle at Gettysburg and then the surrender at Vicksburg on the Mississippi River on July 4th. And it really hurt the Confederacy. But it's interesting to look at it how it was perceived back then. The Confederate soldiers that had fought 3 days at Gettysburg didn't consider that a loss. They thought it was a stalemate, just like Sharpsburg the year before. And both armies sat there on July 4th and staring at each other, and the Federal Army was so beaten up and battered and hammered by taking on Lee's Army of Northern Virginia for 3 days, they didn't make a move. And the Confederate side decided they're a long way from their base of supplies and home, so they started pulling out on July the 4th, the night of July the 4th. And they had huge wagon trains of supplies that they had taken from the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, herds of cattle, hogs, everything they needed to supply the army through the rest of the summer and way into the fall. And General Meade, the Union commander, was very timid about following Lee. He was afraid he was going to run into some kind of trap or something, and made a few attacks against the rear guard of the Confederate. And they were very brave, the citizens of Chambersburg, coming out and chopping the wheels off the wagons that were carrying the Confederate wounded, and the Confederate cavalry had to come up and run them off. So anyway, it wasn't a very hot pursuit, as they say. And in fact, the Federal Army did not even launch an offensive campaign against Lee and the Army of Northern Virginia until May of 64. That was 10 months. So they had been battered pretty badly in the 3 days at Gettysburg. But anyway, we'll go back to the start, and it's interesting some of the strategy that led up to this invasion in Pennsylvania and why the Confederates tried it and what happened and what the reasoning was behind that. So in the early spring of 1863, General Lee had a council with his generals and President Jefferson Davis, and before the Battle of Chancellorsville, Thomas Stonewall Jackson was alive, and Jackson always wanted to invade the North and defeat the Federal Army that was before them right then in May and June. Is Joseph Hooker. Joseph Hooker, the Union commander, was rather interesting. Wasn't that great a military man, but he left us a term that we still use today. He was, I wouldn't say a devout, clean-cut boy. He had women that would travel with him, and they were referred to as Hooker's women. And today, we use the term for prostitutes as hookers. And so that's where it came from, General Joseph Hooker, the Yankee Army commander in 1863. Not exactly a Sunday school teacher. But Jackson's idea was to take the war to the north and destroy the coal mines in eastern Pennsylvania and give the northern civilian population a taste of the war and hopefully bring the war to a close. The Confederates weren't stupid like they're portrayed on TV or on the news channels. They knew they could not keep fighting a war of attrition, and that was one thing that Bedford Forrest was always pushing for, is to try to swing around, stop these big battles. And yes, the Confederates could win, like at Manassas and Fredericksburg and places like that, but we took losses that we couldn't replace, where the Federal Army, with a population about 6 or 7 times ours, could replace their losses and bring in mercenaries from Ireland and Germany to fill the ranks in the army. So it had to be something to end the war rather quickly. And James Longstreet was Lee's other corps commander. He was very critical of Lee's offensive tactics. And there was a meeting at the Confederate White House in Richmond. On the second floor, there's a large room there. I guess it had been a bedroom. But that was sort of the cabinet room where President Davis met with his cabinet members and decided a lot of the policies for the Confederacy. And they had a meeting there in June with Lee and the cabinet members, James Sutton, the Secretary of War, and some of the others, to decide what they were going to do. And the Confederates had defeated Hooker's army at Chancellorsville in the first week of May. And, of course, they'd lost Stonewall Jackson, though. He'd been wounded and then, after about a week, died of pneumonia. So one of the plans that Longstreet proposed, and Longstreet was always trying to get away from the Army of Northern Virginia and have an independent command somewhere. He was, I think, jealous of the reputation that Stonewall Jackson had established in the Valley Campaign in May of 1862, where he'd driven three Union armies out of the Shenandoah Valley and then sent part of his troops going north towards the Potomac River to scare Lincoln and the army there and the troops around Washington. And he held, Lincoln held Pope's army at Manassas and wouldn't send them down to McClellan on the peninsula before right below Richmond. And McClellan was blaming Lincoln all the time because that was the reason he couldn't take Richmond, because Lincoln wouldn't reinforce it. But Lincoln was afraid that Jackson was going to cross the river somewhere close to Harper's Ferry and be in Washington in a couple of days. So Pope's army was held at Manassas. Anyway, so that's what Longstreet wanted to do. And he was sent away after his request to try to retake Norfolk, Virginia, and fought a couple of battles around Suffolk and so forth. So Lee didn't have Longstreet at the Battle of Chancellorsville, which made his victory even more amazing. He was short one of his corps commanders and two major divisions out of the army, and yet he still divided his army and had Jackson march around the Federal Army and attack them on the unprotected flank. But still, they didn't have what would have happened if they'd had those two divisions. could they have finished off Hooker's Army of the Potomac, and then marched on Washington and sued for peace or something? So anyway, they're having this meeting at the Confederate White House in Richmond. It's interesting. I've taken a tour of the Confederate White House, and it is open to the public. And you go on that second floor, and there's that big meeting room. It was a big bedroom, but they used it as a sort of a cabinet room. And to be in that room and be in a location where pretty much the fate of the Confederacy was decided, and that was really kind of a chilling moment to be there and think about what happened in that room in June of 1863. So we'll explain what happened and why the strategy was followed when we get back off our break.
Well, I can't wait to hear it. I'm sure people are really looking forward to hearing it too. Be right back, folks.
Introducing Managed IT Services from NPI. We offer top-notch data backup and recovery, email spam protection, and network security tailored to your needs and budget. With 20-plus years of experience in the medical field, our HIPAA-certified consultants know what it takes to protect sensitive information. Don't settle for less. Give us a call at 801-706-6980 and experience the difference with Managed IT Services. Remember, your IT support should be fast, efficient, and reliable.
I'm Michael Hill, President of the League of the South. I and my compatriots are Southern Nationalists. We seek the survival, well-being, and independence of the Southern people, our people. The League wants a South that enjoys the sweet fruits of Christian liberty and prosperity, but our current situation won't allow it. We must have our independence from Washington, D.C., and the globalists. The present system cannot be reformed. Without independence, we will continue down this path of destruction. To us, this is not acceptable. I'm asking you, Southern man and woman, to join us today to free the South. Call us at 256-757-6789 or see our website at www.leagueofthesouth.com. God save the South.
Introducing PrepStartsNow.com, your ultimate guide to readiness and peace of mind. We offer practical preparedness tools, training, and education to take your family's household readiness to the next level. Browse the prep shop for essential products, check out our planning guides, and stay informed with our prep blog. Visit PrepStartsNow.com and subscribe to our emails for exclusive offers, new products, and future events. Remember, preparedness begins with PrepStartsNow.com.
Smell of napalm in the morning. Smells like victory.
Some folks are born made to wave the flag. Ooh, they're red, white, and blue. And when the band plays "Hail to the Chief," ooh, they point the cannon at you.
Blood River Radio family, we'd like to throw a question out there to you. The Bitter Render says, if I got this number right, Bitter Render, throw it out there to the audience. Our listeners, the questions that you have that we talked about during the break.
I was talking with my son-in-law today. Came by the house and asked, "What do we do on the 4th?" And I said, "We didn't do anything. We don't celebrate the Yankee Independence Day. I'm a sore loser. If the South can't have its Independence Day, I don't celebrate the Yankee Day. And I don't want to hear all this music on TV like the Battle Hymn of the Repugnant and Yankee Doo Doo and all the songs they play." So he was laughing. He said, "Okay, suppose we had won our war for independence. What would be the equivalent of July 4th or Independence Day for the South? And what day would the South celebrate it? What day would they?" And I said, "Yeah, whatever day it was, I guarantee they would celebrate it to get away from the Yankee Empire." But I couldn't pick a date. And, you know, as the war turned out, of course, we didn't have a chance to celebrate that. But that would be an interesting question for some of our historians. I'm Richard Hamblin, I may call him, and Ross Massey and some of the other historians I know, and that'd be a good question for them, see what they came up, or with some of our listeners. They may have an idea on that.
Well,
so anyway,
I'll throw it out there. If any of our listeners would like to call in and tell the bitter ender what, if you'd like to try to answer that question. Here's the number. You could call in and answer that question the bitter ender has put out there. And here's the number. I'm going to say it slow. 208-216-6100. So if you want to call in and answer that question of the bitter ender, here's the number again. 208-216-6100. So feel free to call in to answer when date would be
Day would be Confederate Independence Day. So yes. if we won and we want to celebrate our Independence Day, what day do you think they would? And, you know, maybe it had been a battle or something that wasn't fought in the war. Or maybe, you know, the outcome of the war would have gone on for two or three more years or something like that. We never know. But I thought that was an interesting question that he brought up. So anyway, going back to this meeting in Richmond, Longstreet proposed two or three options. He wanted an independent command again. And he thought that, number one, he ought to be sent west to unite with to relieve the siege of Vicksburg and defeat Grant. And Lee didn't think that sending Longstreet, this is in June, and of course Vicksburg surrendered in July 4th, so he didn't think that they would have enough time to get Longstreet and two of his divisions into Mississippi in time to reinforce Bragg. So, or reinforce the troops, Joe Johnston trying to defend Vicksburg and the central part of Mississippi. So then his second idea was to send him to Tennessee to reinforce Braxton Bragg and the Army of Tennessee and defeat Rosecrans in Tennessee, and he thought that this would draw Grant away from Vicksburg. And Lee knew Grant, and he said, his quote was, only hard blows would stop Grant. So if the Army of Tennessee defeated William Rosecrans somewhere in the state of Tennessee, and Rosecrans was on his Tullahoma campaign moving down toward Chattanooga at this time, and even defeating him, and even if Bragg and Longstreet could march on Nashville and recapture Nashville, they didn't think that would draw Grant out of Mississippi and Vicksburg. He was dead set on taking Vicksburg. So then Lee came up with a third idea. He thought that maybe it was time for another invasion of the North and win a victory on northern soil and then threaten the Army of Potomac where they would be cut off and threaten Washington, D.C. with an invasion from the North and win a battle on Pennsylvania soil and turn around and march on Washington to try to win our independence. That was the strategy of the Confederate government throughout the war, was have a major victory, a conventional victory, between two armies, destroy the Army of the Potomac. And Bedford Forrest was against that. He said the South just didn't have the numbers to replace their losses. So his strategy was to raid behind enemy lines, harass the enemy, cut off their supplies, and it worked. Just the Confederate government recognized it too late. In the western theater of the war, on the western side of the Appalachian mountain chain, he defeated Grant, Sherman, Buell, and Rosecrans. They were the four commanders of the Federal Army that fought in the western theater. So, back to Virginia. Jeb Stuart, the end of June, was attacked, and a surprise attack by the Federal cavalry. And that's the first time that they'd launched an offensive strike against him. They eventually won the battle, but it kind of tarnished Stuart's reputation, and he had felt like he had to redeem his confidence and his reputation. So they decided on the invasion of the North. The Army of Northern Virginia units began pulling out of the line that they had through Culpeper in central Virginia and headed west through the passes in the mountains. And Stuart was then left behind to guard the passes in the mountains and make sure that Hooker and the Federal Army didn't know that the Army of Northern Virginia had disappeared from in front of them. Richard Ewell, on the 16th of June, swept down the Valley Turnpike and drove the Federals out of Winchester, Virginia. And a lot of the people were saying, well, this is sort of like what Jackson did the year before in the Valley Campaign. And they said, looks like Ewell can take over Jackson's Second Corps. So Stuart was blocking the Federal Army from moving through the valleys and found out what happened. In fact, Hooker didn't know that the Army of Northern Virginia, almost 70,000, had left from in front of him, and it wasn't until Lee's army was crossing the Potomac River that civilians were sending the word back to Washington and then relaying it on to Hooker that there's a huge Confederate army coming across the Potomac. So he had to scramble and start heading north. And while he was on the march, Lincoln decided to yank him out of command and replace him with George Meade, which is an unusual situation. You change your commanding officer of the army right in the middle of the march heading into what would be a battle. So Lee wanted Stuart to push through the mountain passes, catch up with the army, get out ahead of him, and feel out the Federal army, which he knew was somewhere to his east or on his right. Well, Stuart gave him two brigades of cavalry to lead the army and do that job, and then Stuart decided it would be quicker to head north instead of marching west through the mountains and then turn north up the Valley Turnpike and catch up with the army. So he figured that if he just rode north on the eastern side of the Blue Ridge Mountain chain, that he could stay between Lee and the Federal Army and let them know what was going on. The only problem was that the Federal Army moved a lot faster than he had expected. And every time he tried to turn west and catch up with Lee's army, he ran into a major Federal force. And he didn't know that Meade now had pulled the whole army out of Virginia, and they were heading back to Washington, number one, to protect the Yankee capital, but number two, try to find out where in the world Lee's army were. Richard Ewell and his Second Corps were in the lead, and they had gone across Maryland, up into Pennsylvania, past where Gettysburg was. There was another turnpike over at South Mountain. And Ewell's Confederate troops were actually on the south side of the Susquehanna River, staring at the capital, the state capital of Pennsylvania at Harrisburg. They'd gotten that far north. And they'd captured a lot of supplies and raided the Carlisle Army barracks and everything up there. A.P. Hill's corps was not far behind them. And then James Longstreet was sort of bringing up the rear guard and the wagon trains and still sending out people to try to find out where the Union Army was. So this is interesting. You had two major armies, the Army of Northern Virginia, Confederate, and the Army of the Potomac, the Federal Army, and they were poking along through Maryland and Pennsylvania. Neither one of them knew where the other army was. So you had one army over 100,000 and one about 70,000 just stumbling, and they were trying to rely on civilians. And the Confederates had a spy that was operating in and around Washington, and he was sending word back that what was happening, that Meade was coming, and the Federal Army was a lot closer to the Confederates than they thought they were. June 30th, Lee met with his staff at Chambersburg, which is a little town west of Gettysburg, and they had no word from Stuart. So they weren't too sure what was going on. They did send one brigade under Johnson Pettigrew, who had gone east and went into Gettysburg looking for shoes, which the Confederates were always short of, and they had a brush with the Federal cavalry in and around Gettysburg. And if you ever saw that movie, Gettysburg, they had Sam Elliott play the Federal cavalry commander, John Buford. And actually, what they should have done was have two actors taped together to play John Buford. He was a little on the chunky side. He didn't look anything like Sam Elliott. But they ran into cavalry. So he's sending word back that there's Federal cavalry on our flank, on our right or eastern flank. So then Lee figures out that there must be a lot of infantry behind the cavalry. And so they decide that this town of Gettysburg, looking at a map, has about seven or eight roads that run into it. It's an excellent crossroads, so that would be their rally point. They could order Ewell and A.P. Hill to turn around and come back south as fast as they could, and Longstreet to move on up north and unite the army somewhere west of Gettysburg. So July the 1st arrives. There's heavy fighting along the Chambersburg Pike leading into Gettysburg, which is west of Gettysburg. A.P. Hill's corps is pushing towards Gettysburg. Henry Heath's division is out in the lead. They ran into the cavalry, knocked them out of the way, and then ran into the entire First Corps of the Army of Northern Virginia. He called up Rodes' division, and they were in a fight pretty heavy all most of the morning of July 1st. And we'll give you the rest of the details of that battle when we get back from our break.
Yeah, be right back as it is, folks.
How would you like to help this program reach more people and earn silver at the same time? Call or text 801-669-2211 for complete details.
News this hour from townhall.com. I'm Jason Walker. At least 32 people now dead in flash flooding in central Texas, including a number of kids, more than two dozen children from a girls' camp, and many others still missing while search and rescue efforts are continuing in the Texas Hill Country. Destructive, fast-moving waters along the Guadalupe River washed away homes and roads earlier in the day. Authorities say more than 1,000 rescue teams are on the ground. Kerrville City Manager Dalton Rice says search and rescue continues.
Typically rescues, if we do find them, they're going to be in trees or we find them, you know, either on high ground. Again, most of the rescues that we are having at this point in time are other camps. So we have a lot of camps and they are all accounted for, but they are isolated because of road damage. So we know where they're at. We're getting them food, water, resources. And now it's a matter of just getting them safely across, you know, low water crossing.
Also at townhall.com, several former top aides to former President Joe Biden have agreed to be interviewed with the House Oversight Committee as part of its probe of Biden's mental acuity while still in the Oval Office. Details from correspondent Bernie Bennett.
The committee scheduled former Chief of Staff Ron Klain to interview on July 24th, former counselor to the President Steve Ricchetti for July 30th, former senior advisor to the President Mike Donilon for July 31st, former Deputy Chief of Staff Bruce Reed for August 5th, and former Senior Advisor to the President Anita Dunn on August 7th, according to an oversight aide. Chair James Comer, who's mulling a bid for Kentucky governor, has issued subpoenas to Biden physician Kevin O'Connor and former Assistant to the President Anthony Bernal for their depositions. Bernie Bennett, The Capitol.
A strike by French air traffic controllers seeking better working conditions, disrupting travel. Officials say some 40% of all flights at Paris airports have been canceled. More on these stories at townhall.com.
Life's unpredictable and full of unknowns, but your vehicle shouldn't be. No one wants to face an unexpected repair that could derail their plans and budget. That's why we're introducing CarShield, the ultimate way to future-proof your ride. We're not just about fixing problems, we're about preventing financial surprises. You can get a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan designed to save you from out-of-pocket expenses on future auto repairs. Imagine driving with complete peace of mind, knowing that if something goes wrong, you'll pay almost nothing for covered repairs. Included in every plan is free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. This protection plan is at an all-time low, making it accessible to any driver. Don't wait for a breakdown to realize you need coverage. Invest in the future of your vehicle and your wallet today. Call CarShield now for your free quick quote. Call 800-894-9190. That's 800-894-9190. Future-proof your ride. Call CarShield now. 800-894-9190. 800-894-9190. Again, 800-894-9190.
Hey, this is Matt from Blood River Radio. Blood River Radio is your voice to save our land, our people, and our future. We propose Christian solutions to an anti-Christian assault on our bloodlines. We love what we do, but we cannot do it without your help. The annual operating cost of Blood River Radio is more than even a team of people should bear alone. With your donation, we can take the fight to our enemies and hold our own people accountable for their treachery against us. Please go to our website, www.bloodriverradio.com, and find a way to help us that is suitable for you. We are thankful for any cash, check, or money orders we get. We also appreciate your correspondence or letters of encouragement. Once again, please help, and thank you for joining the fight.
Former Sheriff Richard Mack recounts in his book, The Proper Role of Law Enforcement, how he came to realize while working as a beat cop how wrong the all-too-common orientation of police officers is when they think of their job as being to write tickets and arrest people. Richard Mack tells of his personal transformation from by-the-number cop to constitution-conscious defender of citizen safety and freedoms. Learn what it really means to serve and protect. Purchase your copy at cspoa.org. That's cspoa.org.
Get ready to be part of something incredible. We're breaking barriers and delivering the powerful stories that mainstream media won't touch. Your support is what fuels our mission to revolutionize journalism and bring you the truth. Join our passionate community of changemakers by donating at libertynewsradio.com today. Together, we're creating the future of news.
Go ahead. Make my day.
Really enjoying this hour right here. Hey, if anybody, if you want to call, call in 208-216-6100 and answer the bitter ender questions. If we'd have won that war, what would be our Independence Day? In any way, with that out there, we'll go right back to the bitter ender, and we'll go back to this one of the saddest parts in history, I guess. But the bitter ender says that we really didn't lose it. The Confederates think that the Gettysburg was a draw. And
They did back then. They didn't. The soldiers did. They didn't see the overall picture, and they didn't know to look 2 years ahead of time or a year ahead of time and know that was the last offensive battle that the Army of Northern Virginia was going to fight. From then on, the Wilderness, Spotsylvania, Cold Harbor, all the fighting around Richmond, it was all defensive battles, just trying to hang on as best they could. So, yeah, we can look back now and zero in on that and say, well, you know, we're Monday morning quarterbacks. We got it all figured out. But they thought they had, you know, beat up the Army of the Potomac, and, yeah, they didn't knock them out like they wanted to, but they thought it was kind of a drawn battle like Sharpsburg had been in September of the year before that. So, anyway, they didn't know what was coming, and they didn't know Grant was going to come east and take over the Army and just Grant the drunken butcher. He didn't care how many men he lost as long as he kept the pressure on Lee. So, but they didn't know that was coming down the road. So, anyway, we're back to July 1st. The two armies have run into each other west of Gettysburg. A.P. Hill's corps coming up the Chambersburg Pike from the west to the east. And now Richard Ewell's corps has turned around after they almost got to the Pennsylvania capital at Harrisburg, and they're coming south. And so the Federal First Corps and the 11th Corps are pretty much caught in a vise between four Confederate divisions, two closing down on them from the north and two that had been fighting pretty much all day coming at them from the west, and they broke and ran. And I mean, the whole two Army Corps, 1st and 11th, were running through the town of Gettysburg, and the Confederates are grabbing them. I think the Confederates were better track men than the Federals had. They were running them down from behind and grabbing prisoners and going into the basements and houses and pulling Yankee soldiers out of the basements and the rooms of these houses where they were trying to hide out. And they drove the Federal Army up and onto the high ground to the east of Gettysburg. It's called Cemetery Hill. There was a big cemetery there. You've probably seen pictures of that big building, brick building. It has kind of a U-shaped entrance in it through the middle of it. And Lee was riding up behind the Army and finding out what all was going on and was excited about this offensive thrust that they had thrown at the Army of the Potomac and knocked out two of their Army Corps. And he was urging Ewell to finish him off, go after him. And he gave him that option. He said, if at all practical. And that sometimes was too much leeway. He could have said that to Thomas Jackson. And Jackson, once he got the enemy running, he hung on him like a bulldog. He would not let go. But Ewell hesitated. And then they turned to A.P. Hill and said, well, can your two divisions contend this attack? And A.P. Hill said, no, we're scattered all over the place. When we went through the Federals, our units were mixed in with Federal units, and we're trying to get them reorganized and get everybody back together and reestablish our chain of command. And so A.P. Hill declined to attack Cemetery Hill. And the Federals were allowed to bring up their artillery and dig in, and that was their center point in their whole line. Now, that was on July 1st. That night, the Confederates sent scouts out to scout out the Federal position and see where they were, and they came back during the night and told Lee, yeah, they're bringing up artillery, and they're building earthworks and trenches on that Cemetery Hill. But down south of that ridge, there are two little round hills, and there's nobody on it. And he said, you know, if we can get our artillery up there, we can fire right down the Federal line on Cemetery Ridge, and we'll cut off the road that's coming up from the south we would be on those hills, and anybody that came up that road would be under artillery fire from about half a mile away. So the Federals couldn't use that as a line of reinforcement. So Lee then, Longstreet had arrived with two of his divisions, Hood and McLaws. George Pickett division was still coming up the road from the valley there and wasn't on the field yet for that morning. So Lee told Longstreet to attack and take those hills at as early as possible on the morning of July 2nd. Now, this is where I think Longstreet pretty much lost the battle for the Confederates. Before they left, the plan was to get into Pennsylvania when the Federal Army came after them, find a good defensive position, and let the Federal Army just beat themselves to pieces trying to throw them off of it, like they'd done at Fredericksburg, where the Confederates had the high ground, Mary's Heights, and those hills behind Fredericksburg, and the Federal Army trying to attack them was just slaughtered down there on that plain below those hills between the hills and Fredericksburg and the Rappahannock River. So that's what Longstreet wanted again. But Lee was telling him, no, we've got an offensive chance here. We've got the Federal Army on the run. We need to throw everything we have into this offense. And said, yes, that was our plan before we left Virginia. But the situation has changed. We have the Federal Army beaten and retreating. We need to throw everything we had in there and finish them off. So I think Longstreet forgot that he was only assistant coach. And Robert E. Lee was the head coach of the Army in Northern Virginia. And Longstreet wanted to just use running plays and dig in 3 yards in a cloud of dust. And Lee wanted to put the football in the air and have his offense going. So Longstreet pouted and fumed, and he took his two divisions. They came out of the Confederate lines on Cemetery Ridge and found out if they went all the way down to the Round Tops, they'd be out in the open. They'd be seen. So they had to turn around. Two whole divisions had to do an about-face and retrace their steps and go back behind Seminary Ridge and go south down behind the ridge and then come out of the woods and attack Little Round Top and the Peach Orchard and the Wheat Field and all of those famous battlefield sites down there. Longstreet didn't launch the attack until 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And by that time, the Federals had troops on Little Round Top. And the Confederate attack was initially successful, drove them out of the woods at the foot of the hill and up, back up on top of the hill and through the Peach Orchard and the wheat field there. And actually, Confederates got up onto Cemetery Ridge. You have to be careful. Seminary Ridge was a theological seminary over on one ridge, and Cemetery Ridge was a Federal position on the other side of the valley because the Gettysburg Cemetery was up on that high hill just right outside of Gettysburg. So now the attack was unsuccessful to put the artillery up on the Round Tops, and the Confederates had inflicted, once again, heavy casualties on the Federal Army, but they didn't strike a decisive blow. And so now they were left with the situation of, okay, the Federal Army's dug in now, and their line looked like a fish hook. If you look at it, imagine this on your map. Down at the Round Tops, so the south end of it would be like the eye of a fish hook. And then the Federal line ran north up Cemetery Ridge like the shaft of a fish hook, and then curved around Cemetery Hill just east of Gettysburg around to another hill called Culp's Hill, just like the curved part of a fish hook. So it's like a fish hook upside down. So that's where they were digging in. So now, what were they going to do? What were the Confederates going to do? Now, Longstreet wanted them to pull back, swing around the Federal Army, and try to find a position between the Federal Army and Washington, D.C. Lee said, we can't do that. He said, the Federals have interior lines, so they could pull troops out of one end of the line and send them to the other end of the line much quicker than the Confederates on the outside of this upside-down fishhook could pull troops from the north and march them all the way around behind the Confederate lines and all the way down to the south, and then all the way around the Federal lines. He says, we have exterior lines, and they have interior lines. There's no way we can outmaneuver them now and be able to pull that off without them knowing we are abandoning our position. And we could be caught on the march, which would pretty much destroy the Army. So Stuart's cavalry then comes in that night, finally catches up to the army, and after probing around the Federal army as best they can, they had to swing way to the north to get around the Federal army and then turn around and come south to Lee's army. So finally they're there. So they decide the next day on July the 3rd, they're going to send Stuart again back around behind the Federal army and attack the Federal army from the rear and cause a lot of confusion, maybe make them think that the whole Army of Northern Virginia is coming behind him. And Lee reasoned that the Federal army were strong on both flanks, north and south. And he reasoned that, or he thought, that the center must be weak because they had to get the troops from somewhere. Richard Ewell was ordered to attack Culp's Hill on the northern extreme end of the Federal line and hold the Federals in position. If he could take it, great, but anyway, launch some kind of attack to hold them in position so they couldn't pull out troops and come to the center. Before he could get his attack launched on July the 3rd, he was attacked by the Federal Army. And Lee wanted to know what happened. He said, "We're not able to attack. We're digging in and holding on by our fingernails." So we'll finish up July 3rd and the end of the Battle of Gettysburg right after the break.
I can't wait to hear myself. Be right back, folks.
Do you know what is great about America? Ask an Immigrant. Ask an Immigrant is a new podcast dedicated to helping Americans, especially our youth, value, appreciate, and be grateful for the freedoms we have here in America. Join host Lydia Wallace Nuttall as she interviews immigrants from around the world to discover their inspiring personal stories about why they came to America. To learn more about why America is the most prosperous, greatest country in the world, download the Loving Liberty app or go to lovingliberty.net.
Okay, listen up, people. I'm beating the bushes for a few good men. I don't want you boys the alt-right. I want the hardcore of the hard-right. And I need you front and center, boots on the ground, at a minute's notice, in the streets, and I need your money. You know the problem that the whites of the world face. It's the all-too-real threat of global extermination. And you know what's going on in South Africa and Western Europe. And unless you're semi-comatose, you've already seen the first stages of white genocide unfolding in our country. Our culture is under constant full-scale attack by our enemy. The enemy never sleeps. They spend day and night wrecking the monuments and the graves of our beloved kin. They attack us physically everywhere we go. They've already taken the linen and our stone. Now they're coming after our flesh. And if you're not too squeamish, if you want to be part of the number one white advocacy group and the number one white civil defense group in the United States, then contact Eddie Bombardier Miller at BloodRiverRadio.com. And please, please donate. And God knows you need us as much as we need you. Thank you.
In the medical field, IT security is crucial. Our highly skilled consultants are HIPAA certified and have 20 plus years of experience servicing medical clinics, billing, and supply companies. We offer comprehensive endpoint protection, guarding your computers and servers against all stages of threats. And with our 24/7 monitoring services, you'll never worry about extensive downtime again. Ready to level up your IT support? Call 801-706-6980 today and discover how great IT services can be with Managed IT Services.
Being this is a .44 Magnum, the most powerful handgun in the world, and would blow your head clean off, you've got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, Bunk?
Dear Blood River Radio family, I cannot believe this hour has gone so fast. I hope and pray, if y'all are enjoying this 10% as much as I am, you're having a ball. It's sad that we lost the war, but my God, I love this history. And I'd just like to say this, I've got to hurry up. You people out there, you need to teach your young people, especially your young people, to take pride in being a Southerner, take pride in being white. I tell you what, the South was right. Anyway, I'm going to shut up and go right back to you, Bitterender, and take us on to the bar, son.
Well, we were talking about the Battle of Gettysburg on the final day, July 3rd, and Lee decided that they were going to attack right at the center of the Federal line, and he felt like they pulled reinforcements out of there to reinforce their southern position on the Round Tops and out of that to reinforce their position on the northern end of their line at Culp's Hill. So they must have gotten them from somewhere. So he thought they came from the middle. And people say, well, that was so ridiculous. What in the world was he thinking about, a frontal attack? Well, go forward a few months to September of 1863, and Longstreet was sent south to the Army of Tennessee and was with Bragg's army when they attacked Rosecrans at Chickamauga, and Rosecrans' attack hit right smack in the middle of the Federal lines, and they had pulled a division out to go to the far left flank where Forrest and a lot of the infantry were putting pressure on the federal line. They pulled a division out, and just as Longstreet's two divisions, Hood and McLaws again, coming through there, they went sailing right through this big gap in the federal lines right in the center. And one division turned to the right, another division turned to the left, and they just, at Chickamauga, they routed the federal army off the field there. So an attack on the center had a possibility of working, and they planned an artillery bombardment. They used their artillery to batter the federal artillery and knock them out of commission and silence the guns so they wouldn't be able to defend the position. And it's what they had done at Fredericksburg. The Confederate Army had pretty much wiped out the Federal Army in their attacks, and then what they wanted to do was knock out the Federal artillery so they couldn't do the same thing in reverse. Also, the artillery, once they'd started this bombardment that lasted about an hour, started about 1 p.m. in the afternoon, lasted about an hour, then they were supposed to limber up the guns and follow the attack of the three divisions that were going to make the assault. It was Pickett's division, Trimble's division, and the division of Johnson Pettigrew. And, of course, now we all know it as Pickett's Charge, but there were actually three divisions that were in there. But the newspapers that were reporting the battle after they got back to Virginia were all in Richmond, and Pickett's division was all Virginians. And Pettigrew and Trimble, they had mostly North Carolinians, so, of course, the newspapers were going to play up the Virginia troops, Pickett. So it came down to us in history. Other than Pettigrew, Trimble, and Pickett's charge, it was just Pickett's charge. So, anyway, about 2 o'clock then, after the artillery had finished, and Porter Alexander went to Longstreet and said, look, we can't fire anymore. We're running low on ammunition. He said, well, can you reload? And he said, no, if we go back to the supply train, it will give the Federal Army a chance to bring up more artillery and repair the damage that we've already done. He said, you either need to go now or call it off. And so Longstreet didn't want to make the attack, and Pickett rode up to him and said, General, are we going to make the attack? Are we going? Are we going? And Longstreet just couldn't say yes. He just put his head down and nodded that Pickett was supposed to go. And so Pickett went back, and with his division out front and three brigade front, and then Trimble on one flank on the side of him, and Pettigrew on the other, and then two more brigades were supposed to follow in trace. That means they were supposed to come down off of Seminary Ridge, not into the attack, but just follow on the flanks, back behind the last brigade on the right and last brigade on the left of this Confederate assault, in case the Yankees tried to swing a unit down off of Cemetery Hill and attack them on the flanks. Another big mistake. They never did. They never left. And then the artillery is supposed to limber up and follow them and fire, you know, unlimber the guns, get them ready and fire on any federal artillery that was trying to fire on them from Little Round Top or the left, which would be on the right of the Confederate attack, or from the left of the Confederate attack near the town of Gettysburg or Cemetery Hill. Well, they didn't have enough ammunition to do much anything about that. And one of the things that happened to the Confederate artillery, they loaded up a lot of ammunition and fuses for the shells and percussion caps and friction primers and everything they needed to fire their artillery before they left Virginia. They thought they were well supplied. What they did not do, they did not test the fuses that were being used on the artillery shells. It was made by a different company than what they had been using, and the artillery shells burned a split second longer than the ones they had been using. So where they were aiming to put their artillery right at the federal guns on Cemetery Ridge, and the shells were sailing over that and exploding back behind the lines. And one of them hit the house that Meade was in, blew the whole front porch off the house, and knocked him into Never Never Land. He never knew, Meade never knew that Pickett's Charge had happened until about 8 o'clock that night when he finally came to. So, but the thing was, it shook up the rear of the Federal Army, but it didn't do any damage to the as much damage to the artillery as it needed. So Pickett launched his attack. They came across this valley. The Federal Army waited, held their fire until it got within rifle range, and then opened up with their artillery with canister, which are those steel balls, and turned the artillery into like giant shotguns. And at the Emmitsburg Road, there was a rail fence. They had to tear down the rail fence to get through there, and that slowed them up. So they were under artillery canister fire from the artillery. And by this time, once they got across the Emmitsburg Road there, that was their last sort of jumping-off point for the attack. They came under rifle fire. And even with that, they still broke through the Federal lines and got a small bit of penetration, but then with all the reinforcements that came back, they were driven back, and they had to fall back across the valley back to Seminary Ridge. So at the end of the day, there was Federal cavalry on the far left flank of the Federal Army, and they saw this retreat, and they thought, oh, man, we'll get the rebels now. Without orders, they took off and headed toward the Confederate lines. Well, they ran into part of Longstreet's two divisions, and they hadn't been into this attack other than Pickett. And so they saw the Federal cavalry coming, so they just backed off and opened their lines up and let the Federal cavalry ride right through, and then they closed in behind them, so they had them encircled. And so they were like the old Western movies of the Indians riding around and around the wagon train. So this time the Federal cavalry was the wagon train, except without wagons. And now the Confederates had them encircled, and very few of it made it back to the Federal lines. So that was the last actual battle on July the 3rd, was that cavalry action down south on the battlefield. And Stuart ran into the entire Federal cavalry back there behind the Federal lines. They'd pull them out, and Custer bragged about what a great job he did defeating Jeb Stuart, but it really wasn't Custer that had anything to do with it. I don't know if you'd call it a draw or what, but the Stuart couldn't break through and get into the rear of the Federal lines, and they didn't do much about stopping Stuart. They did keep him from getting into the rear of the Federal Army. So July the 4th comes along. Both armies are just too torn up and battered to do anything. They're just standing, staring at each other with this about a mile-wide valley in between them. And the Confederates decided, with the casualties they'd taken and not much of a chance of pulling out and swinging around behind the Federal Army, they decided that on the night of July the 4th, they were going to begin the retreat. And like I said, they had herds of cattle and hogs and a huge wagon train loaded down with food and grain for the horses, and long columns of prisoners. They'd been sending some of them back. They'd detached some of their men to start taking these prisoners back down south, across the Potomac and to prisoner of war camps in the south. But that was one problem they had. They had to detach troops to take care of these huge number of prisoners that they'd captured on July 1st and July 2nd. So that reduced their numbers by quite a bit. And they had to have prison guards for all of them. So the Confederates begin their retreat on the night of July 4th, and about 3 days later, they finally reached the Potomac and got across the Potomac into Virginia. And there were several skirmishes with the Federal cavalry and minor skirmishes. Meade finally figured out late in the morning of July the 5th that there wasn't a Confederate army out there in front of them anymore. So Lincoln was burning up the telegraph lines from Washington to D.C. and telling them to just round up whatever was left of the Confederate Army. They were defeated, and just get after them and round them up. They're demoralized. They're defeated. Well, Meade had been, for 3 days, he'd been fighting against this demoralized, defeated army, and they had pounded him, and there were huge wagon trains of Federal wounded leaving Gettysburg and headed to the hospitals in Washington. So they really weren't excited about going after Lee's army and getting in another day's fight with this army in Northern Virginia. So he did launch a follow-up, or tried to follow Lee's retreat, but it was pretty timid. And like I said before, the army of the Potomac, the Federal Army, they didn't launch an offensive campaign against Lee's army in Northern, this defeated army that all you have to do is go out and round them up. They didn't launch an offensive campaign against Lee's army of Northern Virginia until May of 64. That's 10 months after the Battle of Gettysburg. Meade was replaced as overall commander. Grant took over, and we know how that turned out at the end of the war.
Like you said, so the butcher, he didn't care how many men he lost.
Our listeners have a little bit about the first 3 days of July. And we talked about a lot of things that happened in June, so this is our July part of the program for July 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. Thank you, Eddie, for the time.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Render. It's great being you're like Frank Hawaii up north in Yankee Land says, you are a national treasure. Good Blood River Radio family, thank you so much for tuning in tonight. And God willing, tune in here same time, same place next week. I believe it will be the 12th of July. But anyway, see you then, folks. Good night.